London experience. Okay. Perhaps we ought to talk in terms of historical literacy. And if we do, what should students actually know? And there seems to be two, speaking very crudely, two fundamental parts to any kind of historical literacy. A coherent, substantive understanding of the past, something which allows us to orientate ourselves in time, and an understanding of how we know about the past at all, how we can explain things in the past, how we can write accounts of the past in a way which is justifiable. Indeed, in a way which we may have to write even if we don't want to hear that story. The kinds of ideas which kids actually have about the nature of history are really quite fundamental, and they connect up to what kids can actually do with the past. The first two examples up here are from small-scale pilot studies done in 2002 and 2006, and students were asked to what would help them decide about how to vote, about race relations, and about how to predict whether jobs would be easier or harder in the future. It's just a couple of examples. Danny is in no doubt. Will history help? No. Because, as I've already said, in answering an open question, that is where there's no mention of history, but asking the same question. So this is a follow-up which introduces the word history. No, I've already said, times change and people change. Some races may have fallen out 10 years ago, but now are good friends. Same school, David, same age. Yes, definitely. Races are shaped as are people by events that occurred in the past. Tragedies would cause grudges between cultures and lead to tension. Being able to understand this and possibly relate it in a neutral way would help race relations in Britain. Now, the kids divided roughly evenly, slightly more thinking that history would be no use than thinking that it would be of some use. A small pilot in a selective school, you have to be very careful. But what was interesting is they all gave basically the same reasons. History was useful, and it was also no use for the same reason. Times change. What's at stake here is a different concept of change. The ones who saw it as no use thought of change as episodic, event-like, just random explosions in the fabric of time. The ones who thought history was useful understood that change could be gradual, was something that could be understood, and that we indeed need to understand to make any sense of where we are. So their basic ideas about what counts as a change actually fundamentally linked to what they can do with, or indeed are willing to do, things worth doing with history. A more recent piece connected with the UHP project, Kate, asked to write something about British history in the past 2,000 years. I don't know about British history 2,000 years ago. I don't even care about it. History is really useless, because if things change as time goes on, then there's really no need to learn about the past. So kids' ideas about change are actually very basic. The weird thing about history is that everybody talks about it as a practical activity. It's the most practical of school subjects. Any fool can do history. They just sort of memorise stuff, think a bit, perhaps have a critical mind. The evidence seems to suggest that, in fact, history is counterintuitive. And when you start actually thinking about how kids learn about telling the truth and so forth, it's not terribly surprising. The first basic assumption is that the past happened and is gone. Fair enough. What that means is the past is fixed and finished, and there can only therefore be one true story, only one true description of the past. If you add in that we can only know things that we actually bump into, knowledge by acquaintance is the only real way of knowing anything, then we can see that history is actually impossible. We weren't there, so how can we know? And a lot of kids go through school thinking that. Perhaps more now than used to be in the days when evidence actually appeared as something to be understood on the national curriculum. Add in a limited ontology, the notion of the past coming at you in bite-sized chunks, event-sized bits, all of which are potentially witnessable, when of course much of what historians write is about things that simply were not witnessable. I mean, a large-scale change, even large-scale events are not witnessable. We can reconstruct them from evidence, but we can't witness them. And you can see that there's a problem if you think like that. And that leads kids to restricted logic claims as well, or saying what happened in history is equivalent to saying what could have been seen. And of course, if you weren't there, you couldn't know. Now, if you think about how kids learn about telling the truth in their families, this is perhaps not terribly surprising. A window gets broken, mum or dad wants to know how it happened. You can either tell it like it was or not. The truth is known. It's the past that provides the touchstone. It's a fixed, given past. The criteria are all agreed about what is the issue. And so that everyday picture of what the past can actually give and what knowledge of the past must be like is built into young kids' notions of what telling the truth is about and therefore truth itself. So it's not really surprising that a lot of kids think in this way. And of course what it means is that, as many of them actually say, in the end it's all made up. These people don't know any of this stuff. They just say it. Why should we learn it? But this is not such a sad state of affairs as I may have made it sound, because this kind of development of ideas about how we know makes possible a real workable notion of progression in history. Instead of history being just learning one damn thing after another, we can actually build up kids' ideas about how history works, which enable them to operate much more effectively in their handling of the past, in their actual content substantive knowledge. And treating it very simply, we might say the way in which ideas get more powerful is they actually make history possible rather than impossible. Though one can produce more complicated notions of what progression is. If you think history is given in books, just there, then history is possible. If, on the other hand, you recognise that we weren't there, then you begin to question the status of the books, and history becomes impossible again. Of course, lots of kids realise things must have got left over. They get taught, of course. Things must have got left over from the past. And, of course, if they think like that, and they think of these things as providing true reports about the past, then, once again, history is workable. But, of course, in adolescence, everybody knows. People tell lies. People have reasons for saying things. People have ulterior motives. Once again, history becomes impossible. And they spend a lot of time actually doing exercises sometimes which further convince them that history is impossible, because kids tend to assimilate what they're taught to their own prior conceptions. And if their prior conceptions are that we can only know if somebody tells it like it was, and they haven't got to the point where they can understand that historians ask questions which do not depend on somebody telling the truth about things. They're able to ask questions about pieces of evidence which that evidence was not even designed to answer. Once they get to that stage, then things get better. And of course, then there are far... This is only the beginning of a progression. I mean, there are many more complex things involved as well. So, on the one side, then, we've got children's disciplinary understanding. We know quite a lot about that in quite a lot of areas, and as Stuart pointed out, the research is quite widespread. Before we finish that, you can just to indicate why it's so important. Two kids, I'd like you to compare two responses. Kids thinking about how can there be two different stories about the same thing. This comes from a piece of research done for the SRC some years back. But the work of our PhD students and people all over the world tends to suggest that this is very common, and not just in the UK. Chris, different people think in different ways and have different opinions. How can we decide when it ended? When a primary source from a strong Roman influence states that the empire is over, it should be unbiased. Are there any other possible times you could say the empire could end? Yes, because you can have other biased sources, etc., stating different dates. Does the difference in the stories matter? No, because in history you need every bit of information to make a fair conclusion. It all counts. But it, fundamentally, it's a matter of opinion. If you go out into the world with a notion of what historical accounts are that's like that, you're helpless in the face of the multiple accounts you meet in the real world. History doesn't stop in school. In the real world, it goes on. In the real world, you're exposed to multiple stories. And leaving things as a matter of opinion is not a good idea. Compare that with Natasha. It depends on your opinion and whether you're thinking about the empire physically ending or mentally ending. It's people still thought about the empire and talked about it in 1453. Sorry, if people, 1453, then it hadn't ended until then mentally. I think different bits of it ended at different times, i.e. it ended physically before it ended mentally. The empire ended physically when it was no longer governed by the same person, mentally when it was no longer thought about, and spiritually when there was no longer a shadow of it in people's lives. We still use Latin derivatives now, so the empire's influence still hasn't ended now. Now that girl's beginning to grasp the fact that historians ask different questions, and different questions set parameters for stories. So stories are not just matters of opinion. There are legitimate reasons why historians argue with one another and come up with different stories. Competing stories are not necessarily conflicting, certainly not necessarily contradictory. There are much harder things to learn about interpretation than that, of course. But unless kids are taught that first, then they assimilate what teachers say to them about differences in interpretation to matters of difference of opinion. And everything just becomes up for grabs. Nobody knows the answer. It's a typical case of a current emphasis on interpretation, on teaching about historians first, is a typical mistake that we can make if we don't understand what kids' prior conceptions actually are. We have got, however, a problem. The other part of historical literacy is having a big picture, a usable historical past, genuinely historical, but usable, which can make sense of the world we live in. It can be at a very high level, a global picture. Fitting into that can be a big picture of British history. And then fitting into that can be the depth studies, which kids also need to do, in order to cope with the questions about how we know, how we explain, what counts as a decent explanation, and so on. The first problem, I think, Sam Weinberg dealt with beautifully. The whole world's turned upside down in the last 80 years, and still kids don't know any history. And that's in a system, if we shift the question, that's in a shift in a system, the USA, where a clear story is taught. So clear, in fact, that American academics are always reacting against it, and historians are always complaining about it. So if 70 or 80 years of giving them the correct, good story, over and over again, doesn't work in the USA, why on earth should we suppose it would work here? We also have to ask one other question. I was brought up in the 1950s. Okay, the late 1950s, I had a story. I didn't remember it very well. Of course, nobody ever remembers these stories that well. Only historians keep telling you about how they always remember everything from when they were a kid. Most people don't, because they don't remember things they don't reuse. How well do historians remember their physics or their chemistry? And does it mean that what they do remember puts them no better off than a two-year-old? These things are developmental. Some understanding is better than none. These are not all or nothing achievements. Okay, but I was brought up in the 1950s, and the story I had was the rise of the middle class, the great British Empire, and glorious feats of British arms. It really was like that. That was the story I had to learn. It's absolutely been of no use to me. It ceased to be of any use to me by the time I was at Oxford. In other words, you know, within about 4 years of having learnt it, it obviously was going to be absolutely useless. Worse, it valued things according to whether they actually impeded or helped this wonderful conclusion of the great British Empire. I mean, people like the Chartists were just a joke. They weren't serious because they just stood in the way of the rise of middle-class representative modern then democracy. So we had to be very careful. If we want to teach a big picture of British history, it mustn't get to be official history, what the Russians call party history. Not only because that's diametrically opposed to the kind of democracy we want kids to live in, but because it's ahistorical and also useless. But there is a problem. We have to be careful what it is. The problem is that students have access only to a fragmented past. And as I say, the problem is how we remedy that without party history. It's actually not an easy thing. This is an effort by a good British graduate. It's only an example from a pilot which looked at 60 or 70 students over a period of 3 years in 2002, 2003 and 2006. British teachers are the best qualified in the world, British history teachers. They're all, on the whole, at secondary level, good graduates. Okay? They're the envy of the United States. What do they come out of universities with? They cannot, on the whole, it looks as though, I have to be very careful here, this is the beginning of some work, it looks as though they find the greatest difficulty in actually putting together an account of the past of Britain in a coherent sort of way. I mean, this one, interestingly, has no consistent sense of scale, begins as a narrative of events, collapses in the middle when simply he doesn't know anymore, resumes with the Tudors, peters out with Mary's death. He's obviously studied British history between 1500 and 1700, but there's no reference to the Civil War, let alone the political changes in which it figured. And the 16th century is characterised as significant, but the only explicit reason that's given is the time of the Reformation when England became Protestant. I mean, it's possible that the student might have been able to develop that further, but this is typical of what we call a Gappian truncated narrative. The 2002 cohort, about 50% of them were like that. The 2006 were asked a more specific question. We actually asked them to write in terms of themes, not events. About 30% still produced Gappy truncated narratives. And the rest is harder to tell because the thematic approach allowed them to conceal some of the holes in what they knew, and I've been very generous in my first run through. But this is not proper coding yet. This is just a preliminary run through. So I have to be careful what I say. Some are really much more impressive. I mean, this is by no means the most impressive. But what's interesting is the difference in the way it's actually tackled. The whole 1,000 years is studied and covered in the response. He claims to have studied the 1,000 years. It adopts a scale and it consistently adheres to it. This is only a tiny excerpt from a bigger piece, whereas the other was the whole one, I have to add. There are few references anywhere to specific events. What we have are moves from, moves towards, rises, beginnings, transformations, creations and expansions. And more formally, you might say it includes states of affairs, processes, periods, and at least one conventional colligation, the Reformation. It links things into it organises things into themes, and they're the beginnings of some links between the themes, the influence of this religious mix on ideas of empire and British superiority. As I say, this is only two components. You dealt with politics, religion, economics, and so on. But this was much more impressive. But what's interesting is not just that it's more impressive, it's that it was tackling the job in a completely different way from the character with the failed narrative. It's beginning to think about patterns of change rather than events, about what was going on rather than what happened in Denis Chemin's world. Just a quick look at what kids do with the same sort of question. That is, give us, with these kids, the question was, can you suggest a title or some themes? Or what would a story of British history in the past 1,500 years be? Tell us. And this is a long interview, so this is a tiny, tiny component from it. And it's a much better response than most. Tim, it's mixed, because there's lots of different things England is famous for. Famous for war, obviously, but they're famous for Guy Fawkes Night, they're famous for their democracy. Helen, well, I sort of agree with Tim. I think it's sort of like mixed. We've done all sorts of little things, and they were all different. You know, you've got this fighting, and you've got all these peace treaties and things going on as well, which was totally contrasted sort of thing. So this is organised in terms of not a narrative of British history, but national characteristics, what the British are known for. The past is made up of famous people and events. Tim goes on, when he was pressed, any other thing that British history is a story of? Well, I think Britain has learnt, well, not recently, but quite a long time ago, they learnt to be democratic, because people saw how unfair they'd been on the lower class. Notice that is a concept of change picked up over and over again. Change is what people decide to do. It's not something that happens gradually for complex reasons, but it's suddenly people see the light and do it. So gradually and gradually there's been less and less difference, and I think soon in the next 40 or 50 years you won't be able to tell the difference between the two classes. I think there'll only be one class. That's a hard one. Why do you think this will happen? I mean, don't give the causes. What's your basis? What's your clue that's making you say that? Well, just the way it is at the moment, really, because everything seems to move forward at the moment. Nothing seems to take a step back. It all seems to move forward. So this is a trajectory really based on the present, projected back into the past and forward again. History isn't actually doing a lot of work. Okay, sorry, let's...